Welcome back to the Lead Podcast, everyone. My name is Jose Briones. I'm filling in for Ryan Becker for season four. We're here at EC3 and we have Sean Boonstra. Some of you know him, some of you may not. So how's it going, Sean?
The lucky ones haven't got a clue who I am, man.
And please tell us a little bit of bio for those of the lucky ones.
I'm old, man. A bio is going to take forever. I became a Seventh-day Adventist about 27 years ago, got involved in evangelism inside of 3 weeks, and have been doing it ever since. Still haven't got a clue what I'm doing, but nearly three decades now. So right now I work at the Voice of Prophecy as the speaker director, one of those old and venerated ministries. They got started in 1929, so it's 90 years old now, and I feel 90, but I'm not 90. I worked in a number of media and evangelistic ministries. It is written international. It is written Canada. I've pastored a number of churches along the way. But I guess my number one passion has always been, you know, I came out of the world. I describe myself as a recovering heathen. And those people are still out there, and I guess that's what I ache for. You won't find me getting involved in anything except trying to lead those people to Christ, show them what I found here.
That's amazing. Sean, you have a lot of experience. You
know, yeah, I don't know if it's all good experience, Jose, but yeah.
But you have done a lot of things, and something that we're going to talk about today, the topic of today, is stage fright.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Things that you have experienced, and a lot of people will say, like, well, he's Sean Boonstra. He doesn't have stage fright. He doesn't have any problem in public speaking.
No, that's absolutely not true. Every time we plan something, and we've done some bold things, my team and I, over the years, including, you know, we did an evangelistic meeting downtown Rome, which, you know, I must have been out of my mind to sign up for that. So I've preached all over the world, but the one thing that happens every time when we sit in a committee and we plan these things, they seem like a really good idea. I get really excited. And then the night before we begin, I can't tell you how many times I've thrown up at the thought of having to. I still do. I'm speaking here at EC3. I laid awake all night. Oh no, I'm going to have to get up front and speak. Yeah, it terrifies me. Public speaking is not my wheelhouse. Mm.
And that's also a common thing among pastors.
Yeah, oddly enough, right?
Right, because pastors are public figures, but not necessarily public speakers. You know, there's a difference between being a public figure and helping people, and, you know, being out there. And also public speaking. So tell me a little bit more of, like, what has helped you continue to be persistent?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what. Throwing up helps. You just get out there, throw up a little bit. You know, pastors, yeah, it comes as a surprise as you move along. You know, we were all raised in this Dale Carnegie world where everybody's supposed to be an extrovert. And we know that something like, what, 1/3 of the American public, the Western public, it's true in Europe too, at least 1/3 of us are introverts, and I'm an off-the-charts introvert. Like, oh no, crowds, oh no, getting up front, it drives me crazy. And in the beginning, it used to terrify me a lot because I would consider the weight of what I was doing. And I think every preacher should consider the weight of what they're doing. There's a lot going on when you get up front to share the gospel because eternity hangs in the balance. So that made it worse for me. I was like, oh no, like, this is important work. And I'm scared to death to get up front. And I used to think, and you get started in this and you think, well, you know, I'm going to have to come up with the argument that persuades people. I'm going to have to come up with some way that suddenly makes everybody in the room interested in Christ. But if you read 1 Corinthians chapter 2 very carefully, Paul tells us point blank that you can't do it. It's not possible to take a truly secular mind and make them interested in spiritual things. It's utterly impossible. And he makes quite a persuasive argument at one point saying, look, when he comes to Corinth, he tells everybody, I didn't come to you with persuasiveness of speech. I came to you with the power of God. When I recognized, and John Wesley would have called this prevenient grace, that God gets to people before you do and wakes up their heart to spiritual things. When I realized I can't convert people, it took half the pressure off. I thought, I am not trying to convert people because you can't. What I'm doing is hunting for converts, those that God is in the process of converting. Now, our team has worked with some, I don't know, 100,000 people who have come into the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And anecdotally, you know, I don't have hard data, but anecdotally, as I've talked to all of those people over the last 30 years, I've noticed something really interesting. Every single one of them God got to way before I ever did, sometimes decades in advance. And he's preparing them for that moment when they end up in my Bible study or they end up in my evangelistic meeting. And when I caught on to that, and I'm not converting people, I'm inviting people that God is converting home. It changed the entire game for me. I don't have to be persuasive. I have to appeal to people that are already under conviction. And my goodness, you know, I used to lay awake, oh no, I've planned an altar call for tomorrow night. What am I going to do? What if I'm standing up front and I'm that guy who goes on for 25 minutes? Is there just one here? Is there one person here who wants to come to Christ? And what if I'm not convincing enough? And then I finally got it. You don't have to be convincing. You need to appeal to those that God is convincing. And that increased our decision rate like fivefold overnight.
That seems amazing. Yet I think of my training, I think of my training as a pastor and the things that were emphasized for me. Mm-hmm. And even in the work right now, there is a emphasis on baptisms, conversions, you know, things of that nature. How do we reconcile this struggle that or tension, you know, that the conference puts for the pastor, you know, and the reality that we are co-collaborators with Christ, you know, and this work.
We're following him in his ministry.
Correct. Right. And he's doing things and he's awakening minds. Yep. So how do we make sure that we don't rely on our own talent, but, you know, continue persevering in the line of Christ's work?
If you get involved in genuine public evangelism, and by that I mean get out there into the actual world and test your ideas against real live people that didn't grow up in our church. I mean, there's nothing wrong, of course, with working inside the church and reaching the young people that grew up in the church and so on. But if you spend your career out there in the real world, God has a way of reminding you every minute that you haven't got a clue what you're doing. He will remind you every day, you really don't understand this, Sean. You haven't got a clue what you're doing. And after a while, you learn to let go of it. And I think I know this struggle. Like, everybody has to get up at workers' meeting. This year I baptized X number of people. I always remind myself that Noah preached 120 years and had nothing but his kids. And we all know he would have been disobedient to God had he stopped preaching over those 120 years because he wasn't getting the numbers to give at workers' meeting, you know. Now, if you never get any numbers, God does say that his word does not return to him void. Maybe there are some things that you need to adjust because the world right now is so ripe for decision. I had to learn to let go of the numbers and results-based evangelism. As a matter of fact, you know the old model, we'd hold a big meeting and on the last weekend you have a mass baptism. Look at the 500 people in the swimming pool. I stopped doing that years ago. No more closing night baptism because it gets artificial. Is everybody ready on that last weekend? No. Lots are. I start baptizing people about halfway through my evangelistic meeting, and then I try and baptize somebody every day until Jesus comes in that church. And we fill the tank every week by faith. And if somebody's baptized, great. If not, great. I actually don't consider the results of an evangelistic meeting for 2 years. 2 years later, I check back and I say, what's going on? Do the church members now have the confidence to win their friends? I'm more interested in changing the culture of a church so that everybody understands you don't need an evangelist to come to town. What you need is to be faithful in your call to Christ. So I guess I changed my mindset a little bit, and we're still baptizing people hand over fist. Numbers do matter because numbers are people, but I stepped away from that numbers-driven thing to ask, is it more important to demonstrate, you know, a graph with results, or is it more important to be faithful?
That's a very good question, and I think that you encompass a lot of the struggle that the church pastor has every time that they get up to preach, like what's most important. And something that, you know, you've been doing this ministry of public evangelism for a while now.
Yeah, 27 years.
So it's been 27.
Hard to believe. Right. I'm no longer the new kid.
And also like in many different areas of the world.
Yeah.
Right? Now you're in Voice of Prophecy.
Every continent except Antarctica. I've tried to figure out how can we go to McMurdo Station and do something. Right. But I actually tried to figure that one out. God closed the door.
Okay. Well, there it is. But it seems to me that, you know, the years of experience that you have gathered have allowed you to build up resilience. You know, you're resilient.
I can fake resilience.
Okay.
You know, there's the truth. I'm a weak guy like everybody else. And actually, the paradox is the longer you do it, the less you seem to know. And so resilience, you need more of it later rather than...
than in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. There's a lot of tension happening today in a post-Christian, post-secular even, you know, a society that we live in. What is the most important thing for a leader, let it be an elder, a deacon, a pastor, you know, like they are not seeing things. They're not, things are not going as well. You know, they're not getting the numbers. They're not getting anything. What do they have to do?
A couple of things. Number one, I love to do what I'm about to do. I'm going to challenge the assertion that America is post-Christian. Is it drifting that way? Yes, but I do challenge it because I've actually worked in completely secular societies. I mean, I'm an immigrant to the United States. But we still have twice the church attendance we have. I mean, today we have twice the rate of church attendance in America than we did in 1789 when the nation was founded. So are we post-Christian? No. Are we drifting that way? Yeah, sure, of course we are, you know, but... Here's what I would suggest. We were given incredible counsels, and I know that, you know, some people consider that passé, but the counsels we were given at the beginning still make sense. As a matter of fact, they make more sense to postmoderns than they ever did before. And it's my conviction that God didn't mess up when he gave this remnant church the message found in Revelation chapter 14. I mean, it's inconceivable to me that God is calling a meeting this year because he messed up. Hey, Gabriel, let's come up with something other than the three angels' messages, because I didn't see the millennials coming. I didn't see Gen Z coming. I didn't see the postmoderns coming. I didn't see the secularization of society coming. He didn't mess up with this. And what I've discovered is that if you follow, I mean, we've been told what to preach, what order to preach it in, how to reach the audience, how to advertise, we've been given everything. And I've discovered that even when it doesn't logically make sense to me, if I go back to those fundamentals and apply them, I can't explain it, but the results go up fivefold. It's like, oh, okay. So I need to be humble enough to realize that studies are studies. I love Barna. I love all the studies. But I've discovered that if you ignore the studies and step out by faith, every turning point in faith history has been someone who ignores, frankly, reality and decides they're going to trust God to make this a turning point right now. Mm.
Your point of view seems to be that it's kind of like a return to what we were told first.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like the Ephesian church, right? You know, we knew it.
Yep.
We lost it. Let's go back and have a new experience again.
Yeah.
A lot of pastors in America today, they have very small congregations, you know?
Yeah, I've had some of those.
And it's difficult because you don't have the resources or the individuals to start and to do something and evangelize, you know, per se. Right. And you may be doing it personally, but you want to do it corporately.
Right.
You know, it takes a certain degree of perseverance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to continue doing that when you don't see the light. What would you say to people in that situation?
Have a look at Scripture again. You know, every single major story in the Bible is not the story of what was possible. It's the story of what is impossible. And sometimes God removes all avenues of rational possibility so that you finally understand that the point of the exercise in evangelism is to learn to trust him and to figure out that he's in charge of this whole thing. I get the frustration of having a tiny church that doesn't want to do anything. And, you know, I've had churches where half of them are too old to do anything and half of them are, you know, and 12 members. And I also understand the frustration of having your church fight you every step of the way and nobody wants to help. I discovered that never once in the history of salvation history has anybody had everything they needed. And I think God does that on purpose. And what God does is use the word perseverance. It's perfect. God blesses perseverance more than he blesses talent. And he blesses perseverance more than he blesses resources. I have seen the worst evangelistic meetings in the history of this movement start baptizing people because the person's heart, he wouldn't let go of the idea that this is the one thing God wants us to do. I do understand that struggle. Not having resources and so on. So as a matter of fact, we're giving the store away. I've dedicated the back half of my ministry, however long that is before I die, or Jesus comes. Let's hope it's Jesus comes before I die. We're creating millions of dollars of resources so that it's not just a handful of evangelists that have all the nice toys anymore. I'm going to give them to pastors. Everything that we've got, I'll give to you because I remember How do I cobble something together? I've got a budget of $1,000. How do I cobble something together? I'm cobbling it together. And I think the time has passed that we wait for superstar evangelists to roll through town. I think we should all be doing this together. And I don't think pastors should be alone. And so I'm building a support system. You don't have to be alone.
That's amazing. And when you talk about talent, like, you know, not everybody, like we said in the beginning, is an amazing public speaker.
Oh, no.
You know, and sometimes we're waiting for that talent to come instead of like just refining what we already have.
Oh, yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about that dichotomy that we have, because in Adventism, I think there is a move away from talent right now.
Oh, yeah. And there should be.
And, you know, yes, you still have David Asher and Ty Gibson speaking at camp meetings, but the focus is not there anymore as in when we had Net 98, you know, the Net series.
Oh, yeah, the Net meetings. I did a couple of those.
Right. So, you know, like, talk to me about that dichotomy between talent and perseverance.
Yeah, I tell you what. There's a story that I've told here at EC3. But I had a church member who had been baptized all of, 3 weeks. He decided, I'm going to hold an evangelistic meeting. And I said, great, where? He said, next town over. There's no Adventist church there. I want to plant a church. He's brand new. I mean, he's days old in the faith. And I remember the church board fighting that. He's too new. He doesn't have any training. He doesn't have any of that stuff. And I said, okay, well, then one of you do it. Well, no, they're too scared to do it. I said, okay, so he's going to do it. He took somebody else's sermons. He had someone type them out on a sheet of paper. And he stood up front and read them without ever making eye contact with the audience. It's the worst evangelistic campaign I've ever seen. He baptized approximately 25% of his audience. And I mean, it blew my mind. And I thought, this is it. God honors intent of the heart more than, this guy had no talent. No talent. I mean, not no talent. That's a little cruel, but you know, not a talent for getting up front. And I've watched it time. Have you ever noticed it's the guy who hasn't got a clue what he's doing that brings people to church and wins them to Christ? And I think that's on purpose. I think God does that on purpose to send a signal. If you're waiting for your talent to blossom, you know, get busy. God honors faithfulness. And that's really what he's trying to teach us, is to trust him.
That's amazing. Part of the Lead podcast is to, of course, give practical tips. And you talk about faithfulness, you talk about perseverance, we talk about public speaking. How can we get better? Because there's a process of growth for the pastor, for the leader, and you talk about resources. So tell me a little bit more, like, what are you preparing? What are you cooking up? Okay. And how can that be helpful for the pastor and the leader that's like, I want to grow. I want to have that growth mindset.
Well, let me put in a shameless plug for the Voice of Prophecy then. Because 10 years ago, I had something happen. I thought I was going to buy the farm. I got seriously ill. I flatlined in the ER and I thought, this is it. Game over. But I made a little deal with the Lord, which you should never do. And I said, if I survive, you've blessed me with everything. I ended up at different media ministries and I had all these nice toys and I want to give them away because I saw the difference. I know that we love to say that everybody gets treated the same in ministry, the local pastor and the guy who's at, and it's just not true. That's just not true. We earn the same salary, but we're not treated the same. It's just not true. I've been in both positions. And I thought, but there's no reason it couldn't be true. And so what we've developed, I thought, you know, I've got an audience. I'm on in 530 markets across the U.S. and I'm not the best at what I do, but I've got an audience. I get letters every week. I listen and hundreds of thousands of people listening and they don't need me as their pastor. There's a pastor living in their town. That's where they need to be. And so we're going to share the wealth. I am opening basically 1,000. Franchise is the wrong word. That might be a negative word. But I'm basically, any church can open up a Voice of Prophecy office. We're calling them Discovery Centers, and I'm driving my audience to Discovery Centers now. And the pastor will have exactly the same tools that I use, the same evangelistic meetings, the same entry events, the same community events, the same children's resources, absolutely everything that we've got, I'm giving the store away. And we're raising the money to do it. We're a self-funded ministry, but it's my conviction that we ought to be doing this together and not watching a handful of people do it. It's not right. It's not New Testament. It's not the way it was designed in the beginning. And so we're building a network, including I've spent about, $500,000 developing a networked cloud-based database so that if somebody comes to your church, Jose, and they're taking Bible studies with you, but they move away and they come to my church, bam, the second I put in their name, I know exactly which lessons they've taken. I know. So we're building a nationwide network, and we're going to do this together. And literally, I'm putting millions of dollars into not resources. I don't want to give the impression that we're selling resources, because there's a million people doing that. I'm building a support network, including the fact that I'm opening up a center right now. It looks like a TV studio. It's not what it is. Live streaming coaching center. And I'm going to have a phone number that you can call, just like, you know, if you've ever for a frequent flyer, United has a number you can call. Hey, I'm one of your frequent flyers. Pastors can call. We'll do this together. None of us has all the answers, but together we might. Together we might.
It seems that you're putting something that I think a lot of millennial pastors and the new generation actually desire, which is support.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, sometimes young pastors are sent to remote locations in the
and
beginning.
And that's exactly where they're going to send you. If you're waiting for your assignment, there's about an 80% chance that's what's coming.
Right. And then you go to seminary, and then you come back and probably get that same or similar location.
Yeah.
And you don't have the support sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes you do, but sometimes you don't have the support of the conference or as great of support, you know, because of distance issues.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what we've got in mind when we're building this.
Yeah.
Because that's where I was.
And I think that's amazing, because a lot of leaders sometimes feel alone.
Oh, yeah.
And to
pastoring
have that,
is lonely.
Right. And I think that it ties in with our perseverance kind of idea. Like, you know, it's easier to persevere when you have someone alongside you that's
Bingo.
Helping you.
Yeah. This has been a lonely experience for me, and I'm thinking, what can I do? You know, it's one thing to complain about it. When you're pastoring in those remote locations, you can't really have any friends. You know, you're the pastor. What are you going to do? Pick a handful of close friends in the congregation? That's going to go all over the place. It's going to be too obvious. And it's lonely. And I got tired of being alone. And I got tired of having to figure it out for myself. And that's exactly what we're building. It's exactly that experience that I had in mind. I'm not a millennial. What am I? I'm Gen X, I guess. I just missed Boomer. And which is good, because they're making fun of boomers now. But that experience hasn't changed. And those were some of the loneliest years of my life. It's like, what do I do? You know, I've got a congregation that has this problem and that problem, and I'm trying to do soul winning. We can solve that. So instead of complaining, we've decided, let's stop complaining. Let's do something about it. Are we perfect? Nope. Are we really good at it? I don't know. But we'll do something about it.
That's amazing. One last thing, I'd like you to maybe paint the picture for what do you see in the future, or maybe reflections from the past, things that you have experienced and that says, that was a defining moment. That's what made me change my mind. Of course, you mentioned your health issue.
Oh, yeah, that was a...
But something that maybe happened at a meeting that always cheers your heart and makes you remember that you're doing this for Jesus and persevering until Christ comes.
Yeah, I don't know how to pick one, because I guess if you go down that evangelistic trail, Jose, that stuff happens every day. It's like, oh, that was a turning point. That's a turning point. You know, that's a good question. It's the faces of the people that I meet 20 years later. You know, they were baptized in something we did, and they're not just still in the church, they're leaders. And I've got one right now. I won't throw him under the bus by mentioning his name. He was baptized in a campaign 4.5 years ago. He went to Southern. He's at the seminary right now. Excuse me, Andrews. And he wants nothing more or less in the world than to win souls. I beg God every campaign, Lord, we got to get this done. I actually have chosen to believe that this could happen in our lifetime, but only if we decide it could. You know, I think heaven's waiting on us to get this done. I ask God for a new evangelist in every campaign, and I want them young, and I want them from outside the church, and he sends them every single time. And now we're into Gen Z now, I guess, so I'm getting Gen Z evangelists that come in. Every time I baptize one of those and they light up the world and they multiply, let me back up like this, I guess. There was a pastor years ago whose church fought him tooth and nail. We're not doing evangelism. Too expensive. And he persisted. First, he had him do a revelation seminar. Those who were around in the 80s will remember those. And they baptized two people. And oh my goodness, we baptized somebody. So next, they moved into an auditorium downtown, a nice one. And They baptized a church of about 200 in attendance. They baptized 72 people in 1 week. And my wife and I were among those two. And so they fought him tooth and nail, and I've kept track of all the other 70 people besides my wife and I over the years, and they went on to give Bible studies to be influential in the church. Not all went into ministry, obviously, but so far that pastor, now 27 years later, has baptized 100,000 people out of that meeting. 100,000. And I guess that's it. Persistence. I might not even see it in my lifetime, but it's those guys. I mean, the day I was baptized was obviously a turning point. My first Bible study, turning point. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I got seven decisions. I couldn't believe it. And I didn't get them. God got them. First person to walk forward in an altar call, big turning moment. It's like, okay, I know for a fact I didn't do that because I just gave the worst appeal in the history of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and this guy's walking forward. What in the world? Every single campaign's been a turning point. There's not just one, and it's been hundreds of them now. Downtown Rome, you know, people have told me you can't preach this message in Western Europe because it's secular and postmodern. And about half my family lives in Europe. I'm the child of immigrants. So I thought, well, where could we go and hold a meeting so that nobody could say my town's harder? And I could shut up all the critics. Well, we went downtown Rome. And, all hell broke loose. Pardon me. Can we say that? Can we say all hell broke loose? Yeah, okay. All hell broke loose. And actually, the Pope went against me. The Vatican had me thrown out of my hall. And the next day, I watched what happened. The national news gave me an hour of airtime to talk about what we'd be doing at our meetings. And now I'm standing room only downtown Rome, and I watch people make decisions. But it's not the decisions that got me. It was a deaconess in that meeting who said, she was crying on the closing weekend. I said, "What's wrong? Are you upset about something?" She says, "No, I finally figured out that I can do this. We didn't need you." I said, "Bingo, bingo, bingo. You didn't need me. You can do this." She went and knocked on all of her neighbors' doors in her apartment complex that summer just to meet them. And by the end of summer, had baptized 8 of them. Yeah. Those are the turning moments. Jose, there's not just one. There are hundreds of those. And I would say to anybody who's discouraged, persist. It will break through. Persist. And don't be alone. Give us a call. We'll help you.
That's awesome. Thanks, Sean. Thanks for talking and, just giving some ideas and tips and just reflecting on your career. If you want to give a final challenge, this is your time, or any final words that you want to say, go ahead.
Yeah, you know what? It's pretty simple. Ignore the critics. I will take constructive criticism, but only from people who are engaged in soul winning. Everybody else, I ignore. Really, Sean? People have called me, "That's arrogant." Really? Jesus ignored his critics. You whited sepulchers. I mean, come on, man. If they're not engaged in soul winning, ignore them. If someone who also is engaged in soul winning has a great idea, pay attention. But the critics, you're never going to get rid of them. Jesus never got rid of them. Push forward. They will evaporate. Number two, this is going to sound counterintuitive, but ignore the studies that say it can't be done. Ignore them all. Why? Well, I think that was the point with Gideon. He reduced the army so small that there is no question God was in charge. Ignore the studies, ignore the critics, and persist. Persist. And at the end of the day, that's all God is asking us to do, is to learn to trust him, because it's a skill we're going to need in the kingdom. We're not going to know everything when we get there. Lucifer was not allowed in the councils of God. You won't be either. So what does God do to teach us to trust him? Gives us the impossible assignment that looks like it can't be done. Persist.